Hey gang, are you looking to make business cards and not quite sure where to go? Maybe you've tried some online sources before and you were not happy with the results? Well, let me tell you about the one that I use and I love. That's Vistaprint.com. Vistaprint allows you to make up to 500 full-color, single or double-sided business cards starting at $9.99. Simply go to Vistaprint.com, order your cards, and in the offer code, enter BC500. That's B as in boy, C500. Vistaprint.com, get some business cards, start passing them out today. Let people know you're in business with Vistaprint.com.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here?
Hello, I'm Johnny. I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys have all had a great week, whatever it is you do during the week. I've had a good week. I've had a really productive week. I got to spend a Wednesday with my friend Scrappy Judd Newcomb making some music for a third party. I'll let you know as soon as all of that totally happens. I'll let you know what it's for. But it was real cool and it was really fun and we laughed our asses off. And it's been a great week. I'm doing this the day before this comes out. I'm about to head out to the Continental Club Gallery to accompany my friend Graham Weber on some songs, and looking forward to that. And today, the day that this comes out, which is Friday, February 22nd, if you live in San Antonio, Skyrocket will be playing tonight at Sam's. Come on out. Always a good time at Sam's Burger Joint Music Hall. Sam's Burger Joint Music. I always feel like if you're going to say the burger joint, you have to throw in the music hall because it really doesn't sound very appealing when you just say, hey, I'm going to San Antonio to play at Sam's Burger Joint. You got to throw in the music hall or just call it Sam's. That's the way it works. Guys, I have an amazing show for you today. The amazing songwriter, artist, author now, Darden Smith, he is my guest on the show today. He has a new book out, which blew my mind. It was one of those books, like he was booked to be on the show, which, by the way, I want to thank my friend Alex Marrero for setting this up. I've known Darden for a long time, and I ran into him last year at a party at Miles Zuniga's house. It was really a great time. It was great talking to him and hanging out with him. We talked about doing the show, but it was Alex Marrero that actually made the love connection and got him on the show. Anyway, when I was doing the research for the show, I saw he had a book, and it's called The Habit of Noticing, Using Creativity to Make a Life. And I got the book on Kindle and on audiobook, and I ended up starting it out on the audiobook on a drive, and I just was mesmerized by Darden's voice. But the book is amazing. It's one of those books that kind of like blindsides you with positivity and makes you realize you got to go out and live your life. It's basically a memoir, but it's also like an inspiring book. Some chapters are just like a couple of sentences, where he gives, you know, he puts out all this great wisdom. Anyway, Darden Smith, amazing songwriter. He's also got this this fantastic nonprofit that he is the co-founder and creator director of called Songwriting with Soldiers. And this year, Mary Gaucher was nominated for a Grammy for a record that she did exclusively through Songwriting with Soldiers, with like writing all of the songs on the record with Soldiers. Unfortunately, it didn't win, but at least it was nominated. So what a great thing. Anyway, Darden is an inspiring cat. He is an amazing artist. He's a visual artist as well. He's a songwriter. His latest album is Everything. You can find it on all the streaming services, and you can find out all you need to know about Darden Smith at dardensmith.com. I had a great time talking to him, and unfortunately, we were cut short because he had to go somewhere because I felt like this one was going to go a lot longer. But it is like an hour, and it's a great conversation. He's an inspiring and really, really, really fantastic human. Please enjoy my conversation with the amazing Darden Smith. Let's get down.
Blessings, blessings. Though life can get messy sometimes. Lucky.
Haven't you?
Yeah, I've been doing it.
Like your 10 years, maybe?
Yeah, almost.
almost, it started in 2001.
Wow.
It was like a very loose thing that we just did for fun.
For fun.
Yeah.
And then somebody paid you a bunch of money and you went, fuck, let's go.
Yeah.
Who manages all that stuff? Do you manage it? Kinda,
Trish manages, and then we have a booking agent.
Mm.
Yeah.
Great.
And I wouldn't want to manage all those people.
Oh, fuck. It's like herding rabid cats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Which, so, but that's great. That's great. Everybody's got to have a thing, man.
Everybody's got to have
gotta
a
have
thing.
Got to have a thing.
It's a good... You have a lot of things. You wear a lot of hats.
I got a lot of things.
Yeah.
I got a lot of things.
Yeah. It's interesting, but in your book you talk about how it's not necessarily what you set out for when you were younger, but you turned out... it turned out to be even better.
Yeah, are we going? Are we started?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
I had no idea what my career... I didn't even know that it was a career in the beginning. I just knew that I wanted to write songs. And I didn't know anything about music. I didn't know any musicians or anything. I knew how to work. I knew how to work hard.
Yeah.
I grew up in the country, and I just knew that kind of thing. And
where'd you grow up?
I was born in Brenham.
Okay.
So out there, and I grew up in the country, so we had like 100 acres and with cows and chickens and that whole trip.
Yeah.
I wasn't an FFA guy, you know.
No.
There's like that whole thing was happening around me.
The blue corduroy jacket.
Yeah, I never got one. I didn't get the jacket, man.
Yeah.
But you know, I had animals and stuff, but it was great. And then I started writing songs when I lived there. So I was 10 when I wrote my first song. And I was writing, and then my family moved to Houston, the suburbs of Houston, when I was in the eighth grade.
So which right suburbs?
Humble. So we lived in Kingwood.
Okay.
Which is a bizarre place. And
I did some time in the Woodlands.
Yeah, exactly. Same thing, man. Yeah. Same thing. Same thing. Same house.
Yeah, probably.
And no, that's where I fell kind of in love with songs, because I was such a weirdo. I was such an oddball coming from this sort of country town into this sort of urbanish city,
yeah.
You know, with kids from all over the country and the world. I was so far behind them, and I just kind of hid in my room. And it was, songs became my way of telling secrets and telling stories. And it was I was the only person who could do it.
Right.
So it was my way of kind of carving out a niche of cool.
Yeah.
And it was a way to be cool. And then it became, you know, with this sort of teen angst thing that comes up with drugs and alcohol. I did a lot of drugs and alcohol at that time. And it was a way to let all that stuff out, and where I didn't go out and do too much damage.
Yeah,
you know,
to yourself and others.
Yeah, to myself and others. You know, yeah. I just wrote these songs, and in the process, I didn't know I was getting, you know, my sort of primer in songwriting.
Right.
I just did it because it felt good, it was fun, and it was cool. But in the meantime, I didn't know how to write songs and didn't know any musicians and stuff. So I just started by rewriting John Prine songs and Guy Clark songs, putting nouns where their nouns were and verbs where their verbs were,
uh-huh.
to feel, to kind of how it felt.
That's what Hunter S. Thompson did with books.
Yeah, he did it with like, was it Fairling? No, was it?
It was like, it was Hemingway. I can't remember which Hemingway.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It was. I didn't know that at the time.
Like, well, this guy's good. I'll just.
I just wanted to kind of figure how they could make it turn. I remember, how did John Prine make those verses turn?
Right.
And how did Guy Clark make them turn? Towns and all those guys.
And how old were you when you were listening to that stuff?
Well, it started like eighth, ninth grade.
Okay.
So my brother. My brother who had terrible music taste, you know, I didn't have the cool older brother. He's a great guy, but he thought Frampton Comes Alive was as cool as it gets, which it's pretty cool, but it wasn't that cool. And but he brought home, when I was in the seventh grade, he brought home Viva Terlingua, which is Jerry Jeff Walker's, you know. And then I had some cousins who lived out in Wimberley that I used to haul hay with, and they had Willie Nelson's Phases and Stages and Redheaded Stranger and Freddie Fender's Greatest Hits. And I remember one summer, that's kind of all I listened to.
Yeah.
In the country, in this sort of, you know, out there in Wimberley. And it was just magical. So I started with that. And I was into Neil Young when I was in the fourth and fifth grade, because my guitar teacher That's how I learned to write. Was my guitar teacher was teaching me all of Harvest and After the Gold Rush. And you know that really famous picture in After the Gold Rush where he's laying on the couch? Uh-huh. Okay. I'm sitting there in his girl's bedroom. She's like 17 years old, and I was 10. I was completely in love with her. And but I see this picture of Neil Young, and I'm like, who's that? And she said, that's Neil Young. That's who wrote all the songs. And I'm going, that guy? That yeah. guy? Yeah. Trashhead? Yeah. And I said, well, if he can write, I mean, how do you write a song? And she said, well, it's poetry put to music. And I said, well, can I do that? And she said, yeah. And I already knew how to write poetry, so I went home that night and I figured if that guy can write songs, I can write songs.
Do you remember your first song?
I remember kind of, you know, it was about a girl yeah. who ditched me, you know, Lori or yeah. something like that. But I don't remember the first song, you know.
Yeah.
I don't remember the melody. Or I remember writing it. It's in my mother's house, or it was before it got flooded. You know,
Mine was about a girl ditching me. But I was such a loser at the time that it was like a made-up song. Yeah. It was like I didn't even have a girl to ditch me.
Mm.
I wished that I could get ditched by a girl. Exactly.
Well, that's what we do. We make stuff up until we,
yeah,
until we have.
Did you used to play the Wunschy Brothers at Absolutely. Spring Cafe?
Absolutely, yeah. I played the Wunschy Brothers. I opened for Joe Ely at Wunschy Brothers.
You did,
and then I played Wunschy Brothers. I played another place in the Greens Point Mall. There was a coffee shop or something called Dunderbox.
Oh,
and I used to play Dunderbox. Because I had these friends that worked there, so I had this gig.
Yeah.
It was like, I felt like a rock star. It was like, you know, there'd be 20 people sitting there and on a Tuesday night, you know, no money, you know, they pass the hat. And it was just awesome. I loved it. I was, you know, 16, 15 years old playing my songs.
Yeah.
And it's great. I was in bands as well, but.
Did you start playing out when you were playing in Houston? Did you go, was Anderson Fair?
Anderson Fair was there. I didn't know. I knew about Anderson Fair, but I didn't play there until I was about 19 or 20.
Okay.
Because I didn't really play in clubs. I played in some, like, you know, sort of local stuff out in North Houston in bands.
Okay.
And then I had this gig at Dunderbox, and I didn't play Wunschy Brothers until I was in college. Okay. You know?
Well,
and so I graduated in 1980. Okay. And but I did play Anderson Fair a lot and had some very, like, memorable kind of key musical experiences there at Anderson Fair.
Yeah.
You know, and played Corky's in Houston a lot.
I remember that name. Corky's, I think that's before I was
time.
Going out.
Corky's was fantastic. Yeah. Because the guy that booked Corky's, named Les, he would pay you, I think it was $40 a night, and they would put you on solo. It was only solo, and I think it was solo. I know I was always solo, but you would open up for R&B bands.
Oh,
so
cool.
You'd be opening up for Alan Haynes or Charlie Helpin still.
Uh-huh.
It's like, you know,
I like how you use the real
little
name.
Charles. Yeah, Charlie Helpin. I knew Charlie, you know, like, but you know, so, and there was these other bands that you would open up for, and it was fantastic because the audience couldn't have cared less about you.
Right.
They were there to see the rock and roll band, and here's this songwriter on yeah. the stage. So it was many months. It was alternating. I would do one weekend, and Lyle would do the other weekend. Uh-huh. And so, but it was. I mean, Lyle and I've talked about this. It's like where we learn to perform.
Yeah,
it's where you learn to cut through. And if you'd have like 1 second of silence in the middle of your show, it would be like this huge victory.
Yeah.
So, but it was like purposely throwing myself to the wolves.
That's awesome. You know what's funny? I always think of you and Lyle together, and it's because of the Wunschy Brothers. That Scott and Brenda,
right?
Who
I saw like 2 weeks ago.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
They were really close friends with my mom. I grew up with Scott's kids.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, and so they were Woodlands people.
Mm-hmm.
So
very much.
Yeah, very like the creators yeah, of the right. Woodlands people. Yeah, that's his mom, the Cynthia
yep,
Woods.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's pretty wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's where I played my first gig really? At a place.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was 14, I was on stage with Christine Albert.
Oh wow.
And Mark Hallman's uh-huh. ex-wife Kathleen. Did you ever know her?
No.
Okay. Yeah. You, I think I met you through Mark Hallman.
But I know Mark
at
yeah,
the
I know Mark.
Congress House and
yeah,
stuff like that
so.
When I lived there.
Mm-hmm.
Habit of noticing. Sorry.
It's okay.
Habit of noticing. I'm trying to find a way to say this without sounding weirdly fannish, but you know how, like, in the book, Russ Kunkel tells you to go, you know, go on an adventure.
Right.
Yeah. People do things at the right time in your life. I feel like I got this book both on audio and the Kindle, so you could do the listen, and it catches you right up. But I ended up listening to it, and I feel like it came to me like all of everything in the book. Like, I didn't expect it to be how it was. Like, I expected it to be like more like, well, I was born in this place, and what I mean? But it's just, it's very esoteric.
Right. Well, I started out to try to write one of those books, one of those, like, I was born in, and here's what happened next. And it was so bad. It was terrible. and so I just figured I'd write it kind of how I think, which is not linear at all.
Right.
I think more like songs.
Yeah.
And so I tried to, and so what happened was I've always been over the course of the last really, 2019? So 20 years or so, you know, or 25 years, my career has gone up, you know, had some up periods, but there's been some real crashes and some real sort of crash and burns and having to reconfigure several times, like major reconfigures. And along the way, I got bored with music, and I got curious about how to use music in other ways, as opposed to just trying to get on the radio and stuff like that. And so it led me down these different paths. And one of them was doing some work at the Oklahoma State University, where I was had this artist in residence gig in the School of Entrepreneurship at Oklahoma State University. And it was the most bizarre, unentrepreneurial group of people I've ever been around in my life. but I did these lectures, and I came up with these lectures and working with students. And I heard myself telling these stories about music and trying to help college kids kind of navigate life.
Yeah.
But I was using the metaphor of my work of music and stuff. And somebody up there said, you know, you should write a book about this. And I was like, well, I don't know, you know, I don't know how to write a book. And, but it got me thinking, how could I do this? And then when I turned 50, which was, you know, 6 years ago, I don't know how old you are, but when you turn 50. You turn 50, it's like, okay, either, I just had this awareness, like, okay, I've been talking about doing this for a couple of years. If I'm not going to do it, I need to quit talking about it, because obviously I'm not that serious about it.
Right.
And I kept saying, I'm going to write a book one day. I'm going to write a book. Finally, I went, okay, like, you sit down and write the book or not. And so I just went up to the library at UT, the architecture library. I started going up there every day for 3 months because I had a big hole in my calendar. I didn't have any work, you know, so I just went, okay, now's the time.
Yeah.
You know, I've been saying I don't have time to write a book, and now I have time to write a book. And if I don't write the book, well, I need to shut up.
Yeah.
And, so I just started going up there. And so as opposed to trying to write a linear thing, I just said, how about if I write kind of whatever comes to my mind about things I've learned from living this bizarre life that's been based around music.
Right.
And most of the, you know, as you know from being a musician, most of the cool things that happen to musicians often don't have anything to do with music.
Right.
It's the people
and
the experiences that you come to. This is very unique, and it's like being in the circus.
Yeah.
There's a chapter in there about the circus.
Yeah.
And it's like
being... I didn't realize Joe Ely joined the circus.
Joe Ely actually joined the circus.
That's amazing.
he was in the circus, you know, I don't know for how long. but it's like that, and it just gives you this unique way of seeing the world, music does. And I'm sure there's other art forms that do the same thing. You know, theater, probably the same, movies and film. I mean, it's just bizarre. But traveling... as a musician, there's an exchange of money, and we exchange music, you know. But when you have that exchange with a local population, you get hip to all the cool things. Like, yeah. You know where the best restaurants are.
Right.
You know where the coolest people are. You know where the great place, if you're in some place you need to get a haircut, you know where to get a haircut. It's like all this unspoken information that if you're just a tourist, you don't get.
Right.
But it also opens you up to this fantastic sector of humanity with just that are interesting. And so it's been, you know, I mean, it's like I've had the great opportunity to meet a bunch of really interesting people. And it has nothing to do with, you know, my history. It's just because I just met these people, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I answered your question at all there.
Well, I don't know if you did either, but you answered something.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, I felt like you were, like, maybe it was because I was listening to you speak. By the way, the audiobook version is really, really well done.
Thank you. Man, like, we had so much fun doing that.
The music coming in and out is beautiful. Yeah. But I felt like you were speaking to me. I felt like I'm at a time in my life where I did need to hear that whole thing.
I think we all need to. Well, I think we all have our own. First off, thank you.
That's
very, you know, and the audiobook was a blast.
Yeah.
We took the music. So I did the audio stuff with Joel Block here in Austin, who I've known Joel for. I met Joel when I was in college. He had, you know, Production Block Studios. And so we did the audio there, the narration, and then I took it to New York, and this guy that I make records with, Stuart Lehrman, we did it there, and we pulled the music off a couple of my albums. Mm-hmm. So used music off that stuff as there.
Yeah.
And then I wrote some stuff to go around it, played some stuff live, and then had some demos that I just, like, you know, where the phone was on the piano.
Yeah.
Recorded some stuff in just like cafes and things like that. It was so fun. It was like bringing it to life in this way. It was kind of you know, maybe a bit selfish to go and do this, spend all that time and money doing it on something, but it was sure a blast.
It was, and it came out, I mean, it's definitely worth it. It's a great experience having you tell your story.
But I think we all need, at different times of our life, we all need somebody to wake us up.
Yeah.
You know, in different ways, you know, and I've got my people that I go to, you know, and I just feel like they know something I don't know. And, like, you know, and we all have that. We all need that. And
that's definitely
glad I could be that
throughout
the
book
for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Throughout the book, you run into people that tell you what you need to know at certain times. And sometimes it is Russ Kunkel and Tony Bennett. And then sometimes it's your coffee roaster friend.
Exactly. Who I just dropped a book off for.
Did you?
Yeah. But you know, the great thing is that we all do that for people.
Yeah.
And we all are putting out a message at all time when we go out into the world. We're always, you know, it's how do you open the door? Do you or do you not open the door for somebody?
Right.
Do you or do you not help someone with their luggage on the plane? Do you or do you not speak kindly to a kid who may be needing it and you don't even know?
Right.
And so I think most of the important messages that we get and we give in our lifetime, the person giving the information often doesn't know that they're giving you the secret information.
Right.
They're just being themselves.
Yeah.
Like Russ didn't know that he changed. He doesn't even, talk to him. So Russ, you know, he tells me this story about going on an adventure, and I send him a copy of the book, and he goes, "Darden, I have no recollection of this. Are you sure this happened?"
Yeah.
And I was like, "Yeah, it happened. You changed my life, dude." And that's almost better than someone sitting down and giving you a lecture.
Yeah.
I think it's way better.
Yeah.
You know? And so...
Can I ask you a quick aside question?
Yeah.
What was it like opening for Stevie Nicks?
Stevie Nicks, that was a trip, man.
what year was that?
It would have been 93 or 4. 94.
Okay.
It was a record. It was based on it was after a record of mine called Little Victories.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the same agent. That's how I got the gig.
Okay.
And they sent her a list of a bunch of potential opening acts. And she had heard one of my songs on the radio and had her assistant go out and buy the CD like a month before this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so she's sitting around with her friends drinking wine, looking at this list of potential opening acts. And they just happened to recognize my name. And she said, "Oh, get him." That had nothing to do with any career move at all. And they paid me extremely well. And the cool thing was, of course, I was nervous as, you know, Stevie Nicks, man.
And you were playing places like Irwin Center-sized places, right?
Yeah, they were mostly outdoor venues. And okay. So we were playing outdoor sheds. I mean, it was like 10,000 people a night. And I was solo.
Oh,
super freaky and super cool, you know? And after three gigs, well, after the first gig or second gig, second or third gig. Stevie and Russ Kunkel are standing at the monitor board watching me perform, which is like, it's Russ Kunkel.
Yeah.
It's like, I know. It's like Russ Kunkel. He's like played on all those amazing. I mean, I remember being in high school staring at album covers, and there he is, you know?
Yeah.
And after the gig, between my show and their set, Russ and Stevie came to my dressing room. And I was, you know, this knock on the door, and in they walk. And my thought was, okay, that's it. I'm done. I'm just like, that's it.
They hope you had a good time.
Yeah, I'm getting fired.
Yeah.
And Stevie goes, hey, we've watched you tonight. I went, yeah, I know. I saw you over there. You're Stevie Nicks. And she said, yeah, we were wondering, you play guitar just like the guitar that we need. And would you play on Dreams with us?
Are you kidding me?
And Russ goes, yeah. He goes, we've got two lead guitar players and neither one of them will play rhythm. And I was like, you're asking me to play on Dreams? Yeah. And I picked up my guitar and just started strumming. And Russ goes, exactly, that's it. Well, that's the kind of guitar that I grew up listening to that music, you know, that boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the, you know, I learned it. And, you know, I think I did two songs, you know. And then at the end of the first night, Russ... came, you know, we're talking, and I said, you know, listen, I'm going to be here for the rest of the tour, I think, and I ride with you. I'm on the bus with you guys. So if you need any other rhythm guitar, I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, I'm free. I'm free.
Yeah.
And I'm here, you know? And so by the end of the set, I was doing half the set.
That's
which
awesome.
Was awesome. And it's the only band I've ever been in. Like, that was somebody else's band. It's the only one. It was, and I learned so much, like, the other cool thing was Stevie Nicks, after that first night that they watched me, Stevie went and bought, we had the crew go out and buy a black scrim that went between, it went behind me.
Okay.
Because she said, because no one can see you.
Oh, okay.
So she bought, like, she went out and bought, like, spent like $4,000 on a black scrim.
Oh, that's awesome.
Just so I would be seen. And then the thing I learned from that was, I watched Russ Kunkel drop a beat.
Really?
Like almost every night.
Okay.
And I saw the bass player make a mistake almost every night. And the guitar players, they all made mistakes. Looney Castro was playing percussion and he like made mistakes.
Yeah.
And they all laughed. They would all laugh.
Yeah.
And they were so good that you couldn't tell.
Right.
But if you were on stage and you could watch everybody's, you could tell like somebody, the beat went, you know, or something. And I noticed that they have a relaxation and they're having fun.
Yeah.
And if you're having fun on stage, the audience is so forgiving, actually.
Yeah.
And that was the coolest thing. And watching that. And also seeing some of the bizarre sort of rock star things that happen that you want to avoid in your life, if possible.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But
it's like an entourage, like from hell.
Yeah, entourage. Yeah, serious entourage. And, you know, that tour changed a lot for me. I learned. It did nothing for my career, though. Like, absolutely zero. It didn't move record sales. There was no change. It's like opening for Noah at a boat builders convention. And no one cares.
you at that point, you were on Columbia?
I was on Columbia, yeah.
And you got signed. Didn't you get signed around the same time as Lyle Lovett? Is that right?
Well, I think Lyle was signed before. I got my deal at the first South by Southwest.
Okay.
So...
But you were playing like... Remember how... Okay, I'm sorry to keep on using Spring Cafe as like a thing, but... I remember the posters, and remember they'd have drawings of the people down at the bottom.
Uh-huh.
I remember you being down there, and Lyle. I guess I've always equated you two together.
Well,
I think
we were around at the same time, you know, Robert Earl Keen.
Uh huh.
I mean, we were sort of the younger generation after Butch and Jimmy and Nancy Griffith and Towns and Guy and all that David Rodriguez, that whole scene. Those were the older generation, and we were kind of coming up. But Lyle was always older. He was, I think, he's at least 5 years older than me, at least, maybe more. So yeah, we were getting, but I think he had his deal before me. Okay. We were all kind of signed at the end of the sort of glory days of singer-songwriter Nashville. Major label record deals. They suddenly realized that no one was selling very many records. And,
are you talking about like Steve Earle?
Yeah, Steve Earle. Like, yeah, Steve Earle was signed. Steve Earle, K.D. Lang.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of gigs with, I opened up for Steve on the Guitar Town tour.
Oh, cool. Wow.
When he first came to Texas.
I bet that made sense. Well, like, I bet that helped your career and moved the needle up
a
little bit.
Not really. But I did a bunch of gigs with K.D. Lang. Quite a few gigs with K.D. Lang. I did a lot of gigs with Dwight Yoakam. I did a lot of, like, tons of, we had the
Michelle
same booking
Schacht agent. Was one of those.
I did Michelle, yeah. Well, Michelle was produced by Pete Anderson, who did the record with me, the one after. Before Little Victories, yeah, Pete Anderson produced half of that one. And so, I got signed at 86, and I was on Columbia, and so that was, but Lyle was already signed.
Okay, yeah, but that was like the magic, that was like Rosie Flores, like all these kind of people.
Rosie was also out of L.A., yeah. That was the L.A. thing. Jim Lauderdale?
Yeah.
Jim Lauderdale, Rosie Flores, it was post-Blasters, you know, Blasters and Los Lobos had already swung through.
Right.
So Dwight had opened up the whole L.A. thing, so Nashville was just kind of this open place, and Ray Benson got me my record deal.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and I got a publishing deal, put out a record in 86 on my own little label. I had no idea how to do it, you know. And through that, I was playing in LA, got some promo. Bill Bentley from the who was writing for the LA scene, I think they called it. Gave me a review, and a guy from a publishing company came out to my gig. It was literally five people in the audience, and one of them was a publishing guy, and he gave me a publishing deal when I was, you know, so that was awesome. Got paid to write, and then they gave me money for demos. Ray produced the demos and pitched it to Epic Records, and I got a deal.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was like very lucky. I think I got signed before I really should have gotten signed. Mm-hmm. I don't think I was really good enough. I had a thing, but I don't think that thing was fully formed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it was, I just was there though. You can't, you get a deal. You're not going to go, can you give me a couple of years? Yeah. I'd like to be hungry for a few more years. No, you do the deal and you go for it. And it was a blast. Had a blast. And I was miserable in Nashville.
You were?
With the Nashville deal, and I got transferred. I was lucky enough to get transferred out of Nashville to New York.
Okay. Just like to regular Columbia.
Yeah. And then I got put on another little label within Columbia.
So what was that one?
Chaos. It was a very appropriately named label. Yeah. So,
what did you write, like, during that time when you got your publishing deal? Did you write with a lot of other people?
Well, I had a funny thing because I didn't know how to co-write. And then I got signed sort of once again at the end of this sort of glory days of the singer-songwriter in Nashville at that time. The sort of, I think Steve Earle calls it the great sincerity wave, you know, the great sincerity threat. And I got signed at the end of that. And this publishing deal, this publishing company, it was called Dick James Music. They said, we don't want you to, and Columbia or Epic at the time said the same thing. They said, we don't want you to come to Nashville and write songs. We want you to be you. Which is what every artist wants to hear. Oh my God, they love me.
Right.
They want me to be me.
Yeah.
And it was a huge wasted opportunity on my part. I could have moved my sort of songwriting chops so far forward. I could have written with anyone. I could have written with Harlan Howard. Yeah. I could have written with anybody at that time. They didn't want me to, you know, their words were, they didn't want me to pollute what I do. And I think I would have benefited so much had I written songs with people. I didn't learn how to co-write. I did this record with this guy from England named Boo Hewerdeen around that same time.
Yeah.
Well, that was 88, 89. And that was the first time I'd ever written with somebody. And it was like, that was like a magical, like you sit down with somebody and songs just pop out, you know. And then around, after I lost my deal on Columbia in the mid-90s, then I met a guy named Gary Nicholson, who's a songwriter in Nashville. He's a Texas guy. He's been in Nashville forever. And then I started going to Nashville with the intention of co-writing and really trying to work on my song and really trying to, I think I, at that time, I started to really kind of understand kind of a different level of song and really tried to work on that, you know, and with the also with the goal of getting songs cut, which I never got songs cut. I never had that much success there.
Right.
But I sure did write a lot of songs and had a blast.
Yeah.
And still do it. I wrote songs, co-wrote yesterday. So.
Who'd you write with yesterday?
Jack Ingram.
Ah.
And.
Woodlands guy.
He's pretty good, you know. Yeah. And, but, yeah, it's a blast. I love co-writing. But that's when I learned to co-write. It was starting in the 90s and just really got way off into it. I love it. So.
Yeah, it's great. Did you get any cut since then?
Or no, you, I never really had many period. Cuts. Yeah. I never had. And why, you know, I don't know. I tried. Definitely tried. And I wrote with all the people. I wrote because I had a history, you know, because I'd been on a label and I had enough sort of cred, I guess. I don't know that I had the song chops. Like, I'd never been a craft guy. I had ideas. I had ideas for songs.
Right.
But I didn't know how to write songs like those guys write. You know, at that time, if you had a label deal or had been on a label, pretty much anybody would write with you.
Yeah.
If you just ask.
Yeah.
And you just have to sort of make the rounds and, you know, you get recommendations from other people and people introduce you and you sit down and write with anybody.
Yeah.
And they were all number one writers. You know, I remember there was one year where kind of everybody I wrote with in Nashville, they'd had multiple number ones. They were in the game.
Yeah.
And, but it just never happened, you know. Thought that I didn't try. And there you go. It happens sometimes. It's a hard game, though. And part of the reason is I don't live there.
Right.
And it's really never going to happen in Nashville unless you live there.
Yeah.
For me, it's in my experience.
Yeah.
You know. Other people could have different experiences.
It's funny that you say that about the publishing deal thing, because when I was signed to Warner Chappell, mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be like this thing where they're like, Johnny, they need you, and you know, whatever, to write a song with, you know, this guy. And so, but it was like, it was definitely like, no, do your songs and yourself and your band, and you'll get money for it.
I think, you know, which is cool, but you know, I got this great advice from somebody on... When I was on Columbia in New York, there was this Chaos Records, which is the last record that I did on Columbia, was on Chaos. And really all it was a radio promotion department. That's really all it was.
Yeah.
But I spent, and I was the only artist on the label who could play a guitar. Everyone else was rap and sort of urban things that no one played.
Right.
So I was the only person they could send out to radio stations and play. At the time, you could go play on the radio. And so I just spent months with these guys, traveling around with these promotion guys, playing on the radio and doing interviews and stuff like that. And, and one of the guys that worked there, this guy named Jordy Gillespie, who I was still in communication with. I still work with him, actually. He told me, he goes, you know, Darden, you need to make sure that you have a career in spite of your label. And I was like, what?
Wow, yeah.
And he goes, listen... Your deal is going to end. All deals end.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that you have a career. You have something going on in spite of us.
Right.
And it was like, whoa. And that's the same thing with publishing companies. Your publishing company, they love you and all, or not.
Right.
But it's really up to the writer. It's really up to the artist to make sure they're solidifying their place and getting better on their own. And that's the message I didn't get from publishing, and I could have moved myself so much forward, more forward.
Kind of be more of a self starter in that.
You have to be a self starter, and I was a self starter in a different way.
Yeah, yeah.
But I really missed an opportunity at that time to I could have worked with anybody, man.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really kind of staggering, you know. And I've had great fortune to write with some really amazing people and work with people, but you know, I there's people that I could have worked with that would have been amazing.
Yeah, you know? Will you talk to me about Songwriting with Soldiers?
Yeah, so Songwriting with Soldiers is an organization, and we, I mean, the sort of top line is that we, you know, use collaborative songwriting to build creativity. Foster creativity, create connections, and build strengths. And but how we do that is by bringing together professional songwriters with wounded soldiers and their families to write songs based on their stories. So those folks aren't—they're not songwriters in particular, and we're not teaching songwriting. We act as vehicles for their story to put it into songs, and we collaborate by creating conversations that where they're able to tell us, or they tell us their story, and we have way, we have like methods of opening conversations and creating conversations and creating opportunities for that to happen in these retreats that we put on. And then we take these words and they, we craft these songs. We collaborate on songs with people who've never written a song before. Yeah. I got very interested in this process of writing songs with people that don't write songs starting in 2001. Mm-hmm. And it came about, so I started a creativity program in schools called the Be an Artist program that I used to do. It started here in Austin in elementary schools. Actually, it was really interesting. I got curious about this, and I had kids at the time, young mm-hmm. kids, and so I'd go around to schools, and part of that program was I would write songs with the classroom, and so I'm writing songs with 30 people at a time, 30 uh-huh. kids, you know, so I learned how to write songs instantaneously, like, boom, give me an idea for a song, and you do, and you know, 10 minutes later, 15 minutes later, you have a song. They're not pieces of art, they're songs. Yeah. They're songs. There's three verses and a chorus, yeah. and you get everybody singing. And so I learned that, and then I, by being curious and being asked to do crazy things, I've found myself writing with in a place called Covenant House, which is in New Jersey, Newark. So I'd go into Covenant House and would write with homeless teenagers. Doing the same kind of thing, but that's where I learned about the transference of trauma, where when somebody tells you their story and you're listening and truly listening to it, and then you're creating something from it, there's a trauma transference. So at the end of the writing session, they would feel fantastic. And I'd feel like literally like I'd been hit by a truck. Yeah. And the depression would hit me the next day, and these waves of sadness would come, and I didn't understand it at all. Yeah. I'd talk to my therapist, you know, I'd figure that out. And then I did some conflict resolution work using songwriting, the Israeli-Palestinian groups, gangs, like Crips and Bloods, getting them to write songs together, not saying, hey, isn't this cool? We're going to collaborate. Just go, hey, I need a rhyme for, and they start throwing stuff in. And at the end of the writing session, you just kind of point out that you just wrote a song with your enemy, by the way. And just want to say that. And but that's where I learned about, and also at Covenant House, I learned about the power of difference in collaboration. So if two people are very different in collaboration, you don't cross over each other's, you don't cross into each other's turf. And you also are able to create a bigger whole if you're different. And as opposed to looking at difference as a barrier for collaboration, it's actually easier to collaborate with someone if they're different. And you're actually able to come out with a unique statement, because if everybody's the same, it's like you're going to get the same song.
Yeah.
But and then I through the collaboration work with the conflict resolution work, I learned that you could actually work through really complicated issues through songs. And songs, you know, once again, it's like songs hold secrets. They hold massive amounts. You can put decades and decades of time into a song, and all kinds of things. You can put it loaded into a 3.5 minute song. And then it can be sung,
yeah,
and can move forward. So I'd done all that work, and I had a nonprofit going with the Be an Artist program. And then I met a soldier in Landstuhl in Germany, and I'd never spoken with a soldier before in my life. I'm not from a military family at all. And I went, wow, I wonder if this could work. And it just, to me, it was, wonder what would happen if I sat down and worked with someone who'd been in combat and was suffering from post-traumatic stress or wounded, what would that be like? And, you know, and to me, it was like an untapped song field. Like, no one was doing it. No one was writing songs, not like teaching songs. There are always people teaching songwriting. Right. But this is like, I'm not going to teach you how to write songs.
We're going to write a song.
We're going to write a song.
Yeah.
And then you can go, all you have to do is be you. Just be you. And be honest. I'll be me. And be honest. Let's join our forces, join our strengths, and we'll come up with something cool. In the process, you're going to tell me your darkest secret, and we're going to make a song out of it.
Yeah.
And there's a transformation that happens in that. And it has been, so we're 6 years in with Songwriting with Soldiers. We've had, I think we're over 40 retreats. And like this year we do 9 retreats and 30 one-day programs. We're involved in a research program, possible 2 research programs coming up, looking at the neurological effect of collaborative songwriting on post-traumatic stress. And, you know, this is with Harvard. And so it's a thing that's changed my life. It's changed what I think songs are for. Mm-hmm. It's totally given me this new window into creativity and the uses of creativity and the uses of song beyond just trying to get on the radio or, right. I mean, and there's nothing wrong with that. It's cool. Nothing it's totally cool. Yeah, and of course, I want everyone to like love me and come to my gigs. You know, it's like, of course.
Yeah, but there is this other purpose.
But there's this other thing too that's like, and it's been this whole, I feel so blessed, man. I feel so blessed to be, you know, so I'm over 30 years of doing this. So I'm at 32 years or something of writing and like making a living, you know. Right. I started when I was 22, 56 now. And to be like so excited about songs, just songs. You know, and as the business has fallen apart and or not fallen apart, but morphed into this other kind of business, the record business and gig and all that stuff, I found this other thing that is so exciting. It has nothing to do with the music business.
Yeah.
And it's also really cool with Songwriting with Soldiers. I get to work with my friends and these writers that are like these like amazing songwriters. I get to hang out with them still.
Yeah.
And most of them I met through co-writing with them, and they're cool people. They've all had careers. They all have careers going on. So nobody's like looking at Songwriting with Soldiers to build their career.
They're just doing it.
And we all get paid and everything, but it's like, but it's also the level of creativity that we all bring to it.
Mm-hmm.
We all feel like we have to be at the top of our game.
Yeah.
And it really does save lives. I mean, we have like lots of stories of like people like on this song, this experience of sitting down with someone who's not a soldier, who's not a vet, and finding common ground and then putting that into a song actually changed the way they view the world.
Yeah.
And it's changed the veterans and their families, you know, because we work with couples and we work with, you know, kids and we work with, you know, entire family groups, you know. But it's also changed the civilian writers. It's changed us because my level, I mean, I just speak for myself, my level of sort of understanding about empathy, mm-hmm. my complete belief that I can sit down with anybody and find common ground, like anybody.
Yeah,
you know. We did a retreat 3 days after the 2016 election, 3 days afterwards, and you know most people that came to our retreat probably voted for a Republican.
Yep,
you know, and most of the writers are more left leaning.
Yeah,
not all of them, but left. And it was very intense. And I just said to everybody, it's like, here's the deal. It doesn't matter how you voted. Our job is to be 100% neutral when we walk into this retreat. We have to maintain complete neutrality. And if we can mirror neutrality and lead with neutrality in these settings, we can accomplish a great deal of work. And we can provide them with comfort that they're not going to be judged.
Right.
Because everybody's afraid they're going to be judged. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That makes sense. And it was so beautiful, man. It's so cool.
Yeah.
And so Songwriting with Soldiers is this, you know, there's a whole, it's not just about songwriting. There's an entire program built around the songwriting that's created by my partner and co-founder, a woman named Mary Judd, who I've known since the 8th grade, and which I love. And she's like my sister and a partner and everything. So it's really cool. But that program is based on positive psychology, which is the study of what makes us well.
Yeah.
And so there's an entire like protocol for how these things work. It's not just random. Like stuff happens on, it's intentional. The whole thing is intentional, very intentional, where we do it, how we do it, when we do it. how the structure of the weekend goes. It's incredibly intentional and written down, you know. Yeah. And within that, we're able to make these incredible connections. And it's the first time I've ever been involved with anything that became bigger than it's sort of taken on a whole other life.
Right.
I mean, like Mary Gaucher this year, you know, Mary Gaucher put out Rifles and Rosary Beads. Was all the songs are written with songwriting with soldiers. They're all songwriting.
I knew they were all about soldiers.
They're all written through Songwriting with Soldiers retreats.
Wow.
Okay. And I brought Mary. You know, Mary came in. I've known Mary for years.
That record's amazing.
Yeah, and we have the same. I mean, Mary and I were born on the same day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's like crazy. And she's like my sister in a way, and it's really cool. And she was recommended to us by somebody else. They said, "You got to get Mary in this," and Mary loved it, and she wrote all these songs, and she said, "I want to make a record of these songs." I'm like, "Okay, great," you know, and so now it's it's nominated for a Grammy.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that it's cool, Johnny, because that has nothing to do with me.
Yeah,
I didn't do that.
Yeah,
you know, it's like I started the program,
but you're a part of something that's helped so many people.
And what's cool is that thousands and thousands of people around the world have heard these songs.
Yeah.
And 20, I think it's like 22 or 26 veterans. This is the first song they ever wrote. And they're on a Grammy-nominated album.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and it also, what you and I know intuitively about music is that, you know, when we're at some age, we're driving down the road and some song lands on our car.
Yeah.
It comes out through the radio. And it's like, ah, oh God, like I remember the first time I heard Born to Run.
Yeah.
You know, the radio's loud and you're driving, you know, and we're like, I'm driving across the 59 bridge over the Sanderson River and the window's down, my hair, you know, my head's out the window and I'm yelling and it's just like, it's Born to Run, man. I'll never meet Springsteen. I'll never know Bruce Springsteen. More than likely, I could maybe, but I don't have to.
Right.
The story of Born to Run reached me. And the power of song and the power of music is you don't have to meet the people. If you tell the truth in a song, it'll fly out into the world and land on whoever it's supposed to land on. And that is the coolest thing, man.
It's amazing.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Because these stories that came from a really dark place in these people's lives have now gone out into the world and they've moved people and touched people across America and Europe and Japan and Australia. We've gotten letters from those places. So we know about that. Yeah. And these are just people who've lived lives. But that's the power of music. It's the power of story. It's the power of the validity of every story, you know? Yeah. And it's like, so that's all wrapped up in Songwriting with Soldiers. It's been a totally life transformative thing for me and a lot of other people that have been involved with it. I feel really blessed.
Yeah. That's amazing. I was thinking about when you were talking about that, it's a completely different level of doing this, but Miles did this thing. It's called Song Division. It's his company.
Yep, totally.
Yeah. I did a couple of those last week where I wrote a song in an hour with a room full of 30 people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just trying to write about their goals or whatever.
Was it a business thing?
It's a business thing.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Hey, man, I've got a call at 4 o'clock.
Okay.
I can come back.
No, I mean, we've reached a good point. You got to come back another time and do another one. Because you, Darden, I can't believe that.
Let's do it again.
Okay. One of the things I've been thinking about for the last week since I got into your book, first of all, I'm going to listen to it every few months.
Oh, right. Thank you.
For a while, just to remind myself. If anybody that's creative in any way and is trying to do something should listen to that book, because everything that they should also read the book. Sorry, I listened to it.
Okay.
But you know what I mean. It's an incredibly inspiring book, and it really like spoke to me in a way that I needed to be spoken to at the time.
Thank you.
Your record, Everything's Amazing.
Oh, thank you very
much. So the book is The Habit of Noticing. And Darden Smith's my guest. You can go to dardensmith.com. You can find all this stuff, Songwriting with Soldiers, all the things that you do there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing the show.
My pleasure. Love and hope and faith might feel long gone forever. When you think that you have lost your way.
sister.
Darden Smith, his engaging and inspiring book, The Habit of Noticing, is available wherever it is you do your books. If you do it at a bookstore, getting the book off the shelf and reading a physical book in a place, like maybe a coffee shop or something, it's available that way. If you like to do it Kindle style, you can download it from your Kindle store right now. If you like the audiobook, which I did the audio Kindle combo. The audio is him reading it. Hello, did you just hear him speak for an hour? He's great. Fantastic. Imagine if he's saying stuff like, fall in love with what you do. It's infectious. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. It's true. Embrace the beauty of the high and the message of the low. What? This guy's genius. Darden Smith, his album Everything that came out in 2017 is available now. If you want to check out more about songwriting with soldiers, go to dardensmith.com. Get The Habit of Noticing. In some form, it will inspire you. And it's a very engaging and entertaining book. Even if you're not a creative person, I think it'll inspire you to be more creative in whatever it is you do. I want to thank Darden for coming by. It was great getting to talk to him. I look forward to our next on the microphone chat, and I look forward to hanging out with him. He's one of those guys that now I feel like I've got his number. Maybe I should see if he wants to have coffee, but then you're like, he's probably doing something amazing, and I'm going to be like, hey, you going to go to Cosmic? That happens to me all the time. It's the dilemma of my life. Anyway, out of my dilemma, go to dardensmith.com, get The Habit of Noticing, get his albums, his amazing albums, get involved with Songwriting with Soldiers at dardensmith.com. And hey, gang, while you're out there checking out dardensmith.com, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you get podcasts. Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, Android Podcasts. Overcast. And hey, man, even if you're still dealing with iTunes, if you're in the iTunes world and you download a podcast and then you put it on your iPod and you listen to it in your car, you can do it that way. New show every Tuesday and every Friday. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you, Darden Smith, for coming by. Get his book, The Habit of Noticing. Go check out his music. His latest album, Everything, is absolutely beautiful. DardenSmith.com is where you want to go. Have a great day, whatever it is you're doing. Let's get down.
Just remember that you make a difference, and the world is better off that you are here. Love and hope and faith might feel long gone forever, but when you think that you have lost your way, brother, please remember all the blessings in your day. Blessings, blessings. Though love can get messy sometimes, remember all your blessings, 'cause I tell you true that you are one of mine. All your blessings, 'cause I tell you true that you are one of mine.